It's Fringe season, so for the uninitiated, that is a citywide theater takeover where any place that could conceivably be turned into a theater suddenly is one, and original work by local playwrights and performers takes center stage. This is the 15th year we've done a Fringe festival in Kansas City, so today we're getting to know a Fringe regular, someone who's become Fringe famous here in town. He's a guy by the name of Brother John. He's a history enthusiast, a storyteller, and this year he's doing a show about Smokey Robinson.
Yes.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And Brother John, good morning.
It's good morning there, Gina.
Where did the name Brother John come from?
Oh, that's the name Brother John came. My birth name's John R. Anderson. And it came back several years back. I was have experience as a children's pastor, associate children's pastor at a church that I had formerly attended. And at that particular of church, people addressed themselves, addressed each other by their surnames, Sister Garcia of Brother Jones, and whatnot. I'm Brother Anderson. One young lady by the name of Carrie of, I throw props out there to Carrie McDaniel, right there. Yes, so McDonald. She was, at the time, she was about 3 or 4 years old. She had kind of couldn't wrap her tongue around Anderson somehow. She felt very embarrassed or difficult trying to pronounce Anderson. So she came up to me and tugged at my arm and said, excuse me, can I call you Brother John instead of that other name that people call you? I said, well, sure, Carrie. Yeah, you can call me Brother John. And the name stuck. And after a while, as they say, the rest is history.
So it really took hold as both a pastor designation and a performer.
And a performer, yeah. Yes, so I went to choose a name, Brother John. It seemed to fit. And people call me today, like, I don't know a John Anderson, but I know a Brother John. Or I know a Brother John, but I don't know a Brother John. I know so you're the same, one and the same, Brother Anderson, Brother John.
Came first, the pastoral identity or the performer?
I would say the performer. I grew up, I would say as a closet crooner, a bathroom recording artist. I'm singing all the time, anywhere as a child. And my mom, she was also a Sunday school teacher, associate Sunday school superintendent. I also opened up had her own of private daycare as whatnot. And being an educator herself, she would, I grew up, I would say, watching lots of television, listening to lots and lots of music, and reading lots and lots and lots and lots of books. So history and reading is very important to me. Literacy empowerment, it's one of my things that get me really stoked.
How would you describe what it is you do as a performer?
An educator, what I do. I try to be able to, what I do is, I remember one late historian friend of mine, the late Joe Maddox up there, and he had
said remember him fondly.
Yes, the great Joe. Yeah, he actually really inspired me for a particular some of my historical pieces. We got a chance to work with him. Great man. Yeah,
local history researcher, someone who yes. interviewed people firsthand about their experiences
right,
and
yeah.
things.
I learned
really
a lot.
Like
he was a mentor to
history.
Me. Yes, yeah. And so he said, Brother John, he says, what I do and my colleagues, we sit around and just discuss history, pick it apart, everything. We do the boring stuff. What you do is you put flesh and blood and meat on this particular character and you bring it to life. You make it fun. You do the fun part. We do the boring stuff. And so I would say I want people to come away with two sentiments, the same sentiments I get when a story calls me, a personality calls me, and I'm doing the research and I'm going, wow. I didn't know that. Wow.
Your goal is to bring history to life.
Exactly there. I didn't know that part of the story. I knew that story, but I didn't know that part of the story. So I want you to come away like I didn't know and then say, share it, pass it on. Like
what's that. An example of a part of the story you hadn't heard before that called you to tell it?
Is this the part pertaining to the current piece?
Any story that you've found a part that you hadn't heard before and has inspired you to perform it?
Well, in this case of the You Really Got a Hold on Me, a tribute to the music trials and triumphs of Smokey Robinson, doing the research, and I love Smokey. He's one of the last remaining icons in music in the Motown era like that as well, the vice president of Motown and founder of the Miracles. One piece that stuck out to me that I did not know that Smokey for 2.5 years had a deadly drug addiction. And say, wow, what got me here? And you find a lot of pieces of the story that actually relate to you, the individual, and that's what calls me. You, as an I have a a minor in theater, background in theater, the character, you find something that you can connect with with the character itself, the personality. And a lot of the pieces I've done with my historical music showcase over the years, from Bob Marley and Sam Cooke and Marvin Gaye. Last year, I've performed that at the Casey Fringe Festival and the Atlanta Audio Fringe. As you're doing the research, you're finding, you're discovering something about this individual, like, wow, and you find a connection.
What was the connection you felt, for example, with Marvin Gaye?
And wanted to also talk about that alleged last hour of his life prior to his tragic murder, you know, and exploring the relationship between him and his father, that the love-hate relationship they had was...
I don't know about the alleged last hour.
He was
Can you tell me about it?
His father was really inspirational as far as introducing him to music. He was a minister himself and taught his father, taught Marvin how to play the piano and whatnot. But he also, he had substance abuse issues himself. And they were really, he suffered a lot of, say, abuse, parental abuse from his father. So Marvin had that connection as far as wanting to please his father. His father was really distant, but at the same time, he wanted to get away from his father. And so I wanted to explore that, being the fact is that Marvin had a lot. He never really, as an artist, you have a lot of things going on in your head, everything about, and you're very sensitive to the processes of things going on in the world. And Marvin was so prolific as far as getting in touch and tune with the world, what's going on, you know, what's going on, yeah. And so also the fact is that he was suffering from a manic depression. You know, we got, you know, a lot of the bipolar issues going on back in the 80s and 70s. That wasn't something that was really widely, say, shared or talked about. It was really open. And I too was diagnosed with a type 2 bipolar disorder in my early late teens. And so being that connection, the fact is that this marvelous, this genius, how can you create something so wonderful and beautiful and be in touch with the world, but yet you have to struggle with their own personal life? And
it does sound like these characters who have really like made their stamp and who are so celebrated, you seem to connect with them through their moments of struggle or their moments of challenge.
Yes, it's that old, that's a type of sentiment where throughout all the madness, the mess, that something good can come out of this. How do you take this and turn it into something? As an artist yourselves, we are the conduits of say sanity, or we're like oracles, and you're challenging that, and you, how to put it into art. Art, as a friend of mine, of the great Damon Patterson, he's a local artist around here, filmmaker and poet. He said, and he wrote a play several years ago for the Fringe Festival, throwing props out here to Damon's good friend of mine, said, art saved my life. And that is what art has done for me throughout the years. And
how did art save your life?
Smokey, I can relate to that. He said he was writing songs and singing, being inspired with the music that was going all around him since he was about 3 or 4 years old. And that was me. I'm just singing the music, and I love the books and how to be able to take it and want to act it out, want to be able to illustrate it. As you can see right now, I'm highly kinesthetic, so yeah. It's always something moving and shaking all around there. And so art has really been a way to, it's a great vehicle to be able to express in a healthy manner there. How can you be able to help, and I'll help you process what's going on inside of you. So art is very therapeutic, and I believe champion the arts, and I, with young people, and I tell them, hey, whatever you have, if you want to write it down. You know, just get a pad, blog it, do something with it, but write it down.
So channel that energy.
Channel that energy as well. And it's very cathartic, therapeutic, and all those good things that, and you look back like, wow. You can also, if you just journal about yourself, you say, I might not be a per se artist, a professional, but the idea of just journaling and seeing your story, those pictures, like, okay, and it triggers back the memories, okay, and helps you to process. I see, okay, wow, my, how have I grown all these years, and where am I going now?
So you can do it just for yourself.
Exactly, yes, you can do it for yourself. It's for everybody, yeah.
You mentioned also that you've played Bob Marley?
Yes, that was the first piece, I would say, of as the in the Fringe Festival, where my historical, I would say the historical showcase music pieces have, say, was born. Robert Nestor Marley, yes, man, it's the great reggae music, and poet and visionary and prophet as well. And so a lot of his music still connects to even today. And I performed this several years ago at the Fringe Festival, the KC Fringe Festival, and also the St. Louis Fringe Festival as well, too.
How do you research these characters?
I get a question in my head starting out, like, say, what he liked to eat, or what is he like to wear, or when was he born? It could be anything that can get you on that bunny trail, and the internet, you know, researching and just
the
books. The library is a great friend of mine. Yes. And just people actually would give me information or just send me pieces and things about a certain topic. And they're like, OK, I need this. It's like, yeah. And it starts you on this journey.
This is a big question. And I'm sorry about that. But it seems like telling the stories of the past is really important to you. Mm. What does the past mean to you? What does the retelling of history mean to you?
I have a personal model. If I don't know my history, if I fail to know my history, I know half myself. And if you don't learn the lesson, you have a tendency to repeat the test. And so it's one of those things, like, life is a journey. It's a school. And there's things that come up in your life. And a lot of times we may say, like, it's just like, say, an academically, you say, I'm going to take the easy courses. But there's some requirements that you do. You have to before you graduate, you get that degree. Like, OK, well, you took this, but you took all the fun stuff, the electives. But there's one thing you have to do to get that ring credit.
Yes, and you will need your math requirements.
Exactly.
Fulfilled.
So you, and like, I hate math. Okay. Well, what part of math you like? But you got to get that. You got to pass that. And a lot of times in life, we do have our challenges. And I find a lot in the history, the pieces, the individuals, like the struggles they overcome, and like, wow. And it inspires me. Look what they went through. And it's really not so much different even as it is today. It's just the technology is different. We have a more efficient, faster, or unique way of presenting our going towards the objective, but still the struggles, the sentiments, the things they have to go through, the social issues, the racisms, the financial issues, all those things, say, 200 years ago, it's going on even right now today, the values and things we still have to be able to apply. And what did the individuals who successfully overcome that? I believe something like Barack Obama had said something once early in his campaign. He said something, we stand on the shoulders of greatness. I know somebody had said that, and I like that. In our ancestors, our moms, our dads, our uncles, our aunts, our grandmas and grandpas, and people of our like that, like, what have they taught you that got you to where you are today? Those little gems that they planted in you. And I say, Mom, you know, you're right. And a lot of times I listen to my mom, some of the things I find myself like, oh my God, I'm sounding like my mother, like that. Yeah. And so, yeah, but she's right. It's like those values, that truth, those things, they're just intrinsic. And those are the ones that carry you on through those times that you need there.
You've mentioned this show coming up. It's on July 18th about Smokey Robinson.
The first show, The Fringe, starts July 19th.
Oh, okay.
There. Yeah, yeah, it's the official show. There's a few teasers we'll be doing for the KC Fringe.
Gotcha.
But you really got a hold on me, a tribute to the music trials and triumphs of William Robinson Jr., a.k.a. Smokey. Yeah, yeah.
And yeah. You mentioned that you start your process with a question or with some questions. What questions did you begin with Smokey Robinson?
It came to me a piece of about how, what was going on in his life that would cause you, a person, to, and Smokey Robinson himself had said, not me, I cannot see myself in a million years being addicted to this hard drug. Yes, it was on there as well. And, cocaine, you know, rock cocaine. And like, why? I was asked who, when, where, what, and why. So that was some of the questions of you asking. Is there, and the fact is, well, too, of him beginning of Motown, the many connections that he made, that he was a part of his life in those early days, of when did he start doing music? What kind of music he loved, and found out that Smokey loves sweets. He says, "I'm addicted to sweets today." So I don't want to be careful, don't want to jack you for your Skittles or anything like that. As well. But that's not, and I love, I'm a chocoholic myself. So it's like, that's a connection. I love sweets. I love, and so, yeah, those little, the little things, you may not put that in your show, but those things that round out the character, especially, particularly in my case, that I perform him in first person as the portrayal of Smokey. So you find those little things that make him human and bring him to life. Yeah.
So when Fringe first came to town, I am curious, you've been involved all 15 years, is that right?
14 out of 15.
14 out of 15, mm-hmm. Pretty close.
That was almost,
And it opened, you lead up to this year's performance with a medley of your past Fringe performances.
That's going to be on that 18th.
Yeah.
The Harvard Yard there. That's not the...
Your own personal Fringe medley is quite a history to have with this festival. Take me back to when you first encountered Fringe. What did it offer that seemed exciting to you, or just that it made available to you as a creative person that maybe hadn't been available before then?
I heard about Fringe. I think it was a radio interview similar to this. Cheryl Crimi, Mama Fringe. I'd give props to you there. I believe I saw that in some other print ad. And I was wondering, like, what is this thing? Fringe. Right? Not. And so there was a, I decided to give her a call. There was a number for any particular artist for next season. So I got on the phone. I called Fringe and we met at a coffee shop. And she told me a little more history about Fringe and did a little more research and how it began in the first Fringe, the mother of all Fringes in Edinburgh, Scotland. And there were some disenfranchised artists that were actually shunned out of the main arts component of this one festival. So they went out in the outskirts of Edinburgh and created their own festival. And a reporter got wind of it here. This, something's great is happening right here on the fringe of the city. And that's how the Fringe Festival.
And it was started by the artists who couldn't find their way onto
right,
the
Bohemians
stages.
As well. And I felt myself like, wow, that's something that gives me the opportunity. And I tell people, like, Fringe is an opportunity to be able to experiment, be bold, and use this as your own personal laboratory and to be able to do pieces of work, explore that you never have before. And the Fringe has so much to offer: visual arts, dance, theater, teen Fringe, youth Fringe, musical theater. And at that time, I was not doing the historical music showcases were there. That came a little bit later there. It gave me this time to really experiment more. I was just doing more of the oral tradition storytelling aspect there and some other different types of projects.
Brother John, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure there.
Brother John is one of the many participants in the Kansas City Fringe Festival's 15th year. The festival started yesterday and runs through July 28th, and you can get a complete schedule at kcfringe.org. Up next, a vocalist who got her big break singing the national anthem for the Royals as a teenager. That story is next. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And if you've heard our next guest, there's a good chance it was at a Royals game. Laura Noble is a singer here in Kansas City, and she's pretty well known in the Dominican community. She's been a guest on a popular late night show called Dos Por Dos, and she got her start performing the national anthem at the K when she was just a teenager. She's got a free show coming up in August at the Kansas City Museum. And Laura, is this upcoming show a big deal to you?
Yes, definitely it is. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
Buenos dias.
You are coming back from a bit of a hiatus from music, is that right?
I've always performed. I just hadn't really had the chance to focus on my own career and creating my own music. So taking a break was from that, from focusing on doing me.
Yeah. How did it happen that you were invited to sing the national anthem at the K when you were, what, 16?
I was 17 or 18, around that age. My father was working there. My parents were like surrogate parents to a lot of the rookie players who didn't have family members out here. So they would help the players, get around town, go to doctor's appointments, things like that. So we always had players just hanging out at the house.
Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah. So my my mom cooks really well. And by the way, she's been cooking for the Royals, I would say, 8 to 10 years. She caters for them. What would happen was she would cook before going to work and for her second shift. And she would leave basically the door unlocked, and a bunch of players would come by before going to the stadium and eat her food. And then other players from other teams found out that she cooked Dominican food. So they would, my brother now works there at the stadium in the clubhouse with the players. They would ask her, you know, or they would ask my brother, hey, do you know anybody around town that cooks? Or, oh, I heard your mom cooks really good. So she would have to go drop food off at the hotel, or my brother would take food to the stadium. Well, then they just decided to go ahead and hire her and have her cook. And she actually cooked up until the very last game of the championship.
And it's the players were seeking out specifically Dominican food.
Yes.
Like what kinds of dishes?
So she cooks moro, which is like rice and beans mixed together, cooked together. Pollo guisao, which is like sauteed chicken that's very flavorful. Different dishes that she would do, like plantains and breakfast foods, things like that. So, yeah.
Sounds really good. Do you, what was it like to grow up with the Royals, like who are celebrities to most of the cities, these baseball players, sort of like coming and going from your house?
It was fun because, you know, they felt comfortable, like they had a family. So, you know, we developed friendships with them. And through that is how, for example, I got to sing at Angel Berroa's wedding in Dominican Republic. Him and his wife had a favorite Alicia Keys song. So, you know, they flew me out there and had me perform during the reception, which was really nice. And so, yes, it had its perks, which brings me to Carlos Febles actually turned in my CD of the national anthem at the stadium and said, hey, you should put this girl on. So that's when it started, and I went on to do a few more national anthems. And then a couple years ago, I had about 16 relatives in town, so it was perfect timing when I did God Bless America.
That's so cool.
So it was so fun.
How did you, so you already had a CD though, had you been sort of like shopping your music around, or did you already kind of have a career going at that point?
Actually, that was a CD of just me doing the national anthem, but I had only recorded, so my only experience in the studio was that and singing, recording like a song by Monica, Angel of Mine, I think is what it was. But no, I didn't really start recording until a few years later. Ruben Armstrong, Technico Brothers, he recorded some reggaeton songs for me. And during that time, I went on to work with, I was able to open up for other artists like John B. in Minneapolis, Trina in Fort Myers, Florida. I got to open for this boy group in Atlanta at the Bonner Brothers Hair Show. So I was able to do a few things, a handful of things that was really fun.
And it sounds like your first experiences in music, so many people's start, like the path is very close and local. And it sounds like from the beginning, you were traveling to other countries. You were traveling around the United States. What was that like?
It was really fun. And really, it was all just a learning experience for me, because things are ever changing in the music business. So for me to be able to open for certain artists, sometimes it went really great. Other times things, you know, don't go the way they're supposed to. So you just take notes along the way. You just learn what you need to do next time. And it's still that way to this day. I've been performing with live bands for about 11 years now, 10, 11 years. And I've learned, and they're usually 3 to 4 hour shows at wedding receptions or casinos, bars, big corporate events, festivals. Things aren't always going to go 100% perfect. But as long as you go out there and have fun, that's all that matters.
Is this what you've always wanted to do?
Yes.
Just yes.
Yes. From a young age, I knew it. I said, people would always ask me, what do you want to be when you grow up? I'm like, I'm going to be a professional singer. And then as you get older, you become a teenager. They're like, no, what really do you want to do? And I'm like, oh, I guess I should start thinking about a backup plan.
Did you have a backup plan, or have you like just stuck with that absolute confidence you had as a kid?
I felt like I needed to have one. So I thought about a few different things. I wanted to be a teacher. So I went to college for a couple years for that. And I also thought about doing paralegal studies and did some classes for that. And I thought I wanted to be a detective.
Ooh.
Yeah. And so just a bunch of different, and I just didn't have the passion for, I love those things, but I didn't have a passion the way that I did for music.
Not what you needed to see those things through.
Right. And so I just always went right back to music because that was my comfort zone.
You've mentioned that your parents were kind of like surrogate parents for a lot of the Royals players. And it sounds like specifically the Dominican Royals players.
Yes.
And were your parents themselves their immigrants?
Yes. So I was born in Dominican Republic as well.
Oh.
And my older brother, Miguel, was as well. And I actually have four brothers. And hey, guys, what's up? I know they're listening right now. But I mean, my parents also became good friends with a lot of different players as well. It wasn't just the Dominicans. It was a bunch of the Hispanic guys, you know.
Given the state of the national conversation about immigration, I'm not going to ask you to talk politics at all. But like,
okay.
Given the state of that conversation, and when you think about like immigration, particularly across the southern border of the U.S. mm-hmm. being such a hot button thing, so polarizing for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean something to you to think about like singing the national anthem in front of a ton of people at the stadium, in front of people from all different backgrounds and of every political persuasion, which is exactly what you get at a ball game?
Yes. So my parents and my brother and I had to go through that whole process of becoming citizens. So we had to go through the paperwork and the interviews, and it's very time consuming and costly. So I understand several points of views, but we are also law abiding citizens. So we understand, again, several points of views. I do know the history of the national anthem. But
what can you tell me about the history of it?
Well,
I don't know if I know a lot of the history of the national anthem.
I do need to thoroughly research it, but I do know that there are things that have been omitted from the national anthem because they just wouldn't be appropriate for right now, the present. I know that there's a lot of pride for this country, as there should be, but I know that there are a lot of things that definitely need to change. And I don't agree with some things going on right now. And I don't usually get into politics. I kind of keep my opinions to myself a lot of times. I know that that's not going to be possible forever. But what I do believe is that things just need to be done the right way within the right moral compass. I think that people need to, you know, the media is, you just never know what to believe these days. And so I try to just observe and wait things out and see what is what. And what I've learned is just from people's personal experiences. So I know that there are a lot of people have gone through a lot of different experiences.
Do you think that your experience performing in a baseball stadium set the stage for what you expected out of your career? Because, I mean, that is a huge crowd to have so mm-hmm. early on when you're still 17 or 18.
Yeah, so the story with that was when I was set on the calendar to perform to do the national anthem at the Royals, before I did it, I went out to New York to visit family because I lived in New York for a little bit as a kid. My uncle took me to a Yankees game, and he was telling me horror stories about like people who have done the anthem and got booed. And so I got so nervous, and I thought, oh my gosh, what if I mess up? This is going to be crazy. So when I get to the stadium, I was for me to sing the anthem back in Kansas City, I was so nervous. And then I found out, oh, you don't have to sing live. You just, back then, you lip sing to your own recording.
Oh.
That's changed. So now you do it live. And I was one of the first people, when they invited me back to do the anthem, to sing it live. They said the only other person who had done it live at that point was Reba McEntire. So she, and the sound delay is so big that she messed up. Yeah, and so.
They told you that ahead of time?
Yes.
The only other person who's done this so far is Reba McEntire, and yeah. She messed up.
Yeah, oh, and God. So I'm like, here we go. So they said, you know, make sure that you don't lag, because you'll hear yourself, and, you know, it's tough.
Just keep going.
Yeah, it's tough to not stop. So I had to do that. But that reminds me, I did do a national anthem at one of the raceway, the Kansas City.
The Speedway,
yes. And they actually gave me a headset because they said, this sound delay is horrible. You're going to need this in your ear. So I was able to pull it off with an in-ear. Yeah.
Well, so since then, you've recorded a lot, you've performed a lot. And as I mentioned, you've been on a late night Dominican show.
Two of them, actually. I forgot the name of the other one. And I also had performed at a Spanish version of American Idol. It's not American Idol, but it's similar, out in LA, and it's Spanish based. But yeah, I've done a few shows. They're fun.
So I want to play a song that you provided for us as one of the songs that, like, means a lot to you from all of the work you've done. This is a song called Love Aura, and I love it for a lot of reasons. I just plain old love it, but also it demonstrates this really interesting intermingling of Spanish and English. Do you want to say anything about this song before we listen?
Yes. You know, nowadays with music, sometimes we can get away from just good old-fashioned, clean music. And, I mean, not to down any other kind of music, but I really want to spread positivity. And this song talks about unity and how love is what we need. I mean, love ahora means love now. And this is the type of song that is relatable to any community. It's an international sound. It speaks of how we just need to come together. And when we come together, whether it's a community or a nation or worldwide, we can accomplish so much more united.
Okay, here it is, Laura Noble's Love Aura.
Strings hear the conga beat. You know when it hits you, lo sientes en ti. Corre por mis venas, the love is so strong. Amor a mi tierra, nunca te olvido. Tenemos la victoria, tenemos el valor.
Love ahora, ahora el ahora.
My brothers and sisters, we win together.
Love ahora.
So I love this, Laura, and I want you to tell me about the band.
So, you mean in the song?
Yeah.
Okay, well, actually, the sounds were all put together by David Foreman. He is a producer based out of LA.
So this is just not a band.
It's not a band.
That's amazing.
It's all studio creation, which tells us about our technology these days. You can pretty much create anything on a computer. And he's a super, super talented producer who I started working with for licensing movie and TV placements. So I had written a few songs and recorded a few songs that are now on a catalog for TV and movie.
And you do have a band in Kansas City.
I do. I've been with a band for about 10 years named Musivo Live. And some of you might know us from our old name, Kansas KC All-Stars. And these guys are great. They're like my weekend family. Been performing with them for a long time, weddings, corporate events, outdoor festivals, things like that. But I have also been fortunate enough to sub with other bands and get to know more of the band community out here in Kansas City. And you develop all these friendships and relationships with musicians out here and other singers.
Who will you be performing with at this show on August 9th at the Kansas City Museum?
My own band. So the Laura Noble Band will be out there. So Kay Dilla, Brian Alford, they have performed with me, as well as Jay Stanley has also performed with me at Hush on Broadway. I have a residency there. I'm there once a month. And these are the guys that have performed with me. They also performed with me at the Negro Leagues Museum for the induction of a Hall of Famer Hispanic baseball player. And that's how I was able to get this gig at the museum.
It's interesting. I mean, it seems like you perform a lot at the institutions of Kansas City, and not yes. just arts institutions, but I mean, sports institutions and local history institutions. Does that mean something to you? Is that a choice?
Yeah, it really does. It's kind of things that just happen. I'm just kind of going where I'm led to. Of course, you know, if I've had to turn down certain gigs, but I just feel really fortunate. I feel really, really thankful that people have invited me to do certain shows at certain places, especially these important places in Kansas City.
Laura Noble, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And in just a minute, we will meet the New York City novelist who set her books in Kansas City. She is not getting the appreciative response she might have liked. We'll get to the bottom of it. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I just received my press copy of a new novel, a colorful hardcover called You've Been Volunteered, a class mom novel. And between the dedication and the first page, there is an unusual feature, a page with a little note addressed to the fine folks of Kansas City. It definitely intrigued me, and I'm going to read that note to you now. Here we go. A note to the fine folks of Kansas City. I have loved setting my books in Kansas City. I try to be as accurate as possible, but please forgive me when I do take poetic license with some things. This is a work of fiction, and sometimes I do need to do it to advance the plot. Thanks for understanding, and please, no more hate mail. Lori Gelman wrote the book and the note, and she's with us now. Hi, Lori.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So, no more hate mail. Girl, what did you do?
No, you know what? And I shouldn't have said hate mail. And if you know my sense of humor from reading the book, you realize I was overstating the hate mail aspect. But I did receive a lot of blowback from Kansas City just for little things that I did, or I had the facts wrong on, say, you know, where Kansas State was versus University of Kansas. That was a big one. Just, you know, you couldn't get there from here. That's not a stone's throw from somewhere else. And, you know, and it's my fault. I mean, I should have done a lot more research. So I'm glad they called me out. But there were times where I was like, oh, I know it's not going to make sense. But, you know, it's like when someone sets up something in New York City and they all of a sudden they were in Central Park and then they're down at 52nd Street. And I'm like, wait a minute, that can't happen. But you sort of let it go because it advances the plot, you know.
What does it mean to you that the people of Kansas City have not let it go?
Oh, it's not a controversy. I don't think it was. It's really a bad thing. I'm just hoping that they enjoy the books. Really, you know, I'm waiting to see if I get any email from the next book, because the first one, you know, it was quite comical.
Tell me about your Class Mom books, but like elevator pitch version.
Oh, okay. So Class Mom is basically the story of one mom who is the mom that volunteers in the classroom to be the liaison between the teacher and the parents. She always volunteers in the class. And if you've ever done it, you know, it's the most thankless job on the planet. And it's pretty soul sucking and pride swallowing and many, many other things. You're dealing with so many different personalities. So the first book has our heroine, Jen Dixon, jumping into it after many, many years. And then in the second book, she continues her self-flagellation by going at it again. And then this time she's also in charge of the safety patrol.
Okay. I mean, I don't want to stick with the book too much, but when you say self-flagellation, she is not just putting herself through stuff. She's pretty hard on other people too.
Oh yeah. No, she's very snarky. She's very acerbic. What she really wants is for everybody to just lighten up about parenting in general, and especially about, you know, being a participant in your school's fabric. You know, so many times people just ignore something from the class mother. They, you know, you send it out an email and you just get crickets in response. So when I was a class mom, I absolutely had that thought in my head that I'm going to make everybody want to write me back. And I sort of led that into my character, Jen.
Okay, so why did you, a New York City resident, choose to set these novels in Kansas City?
Well, because first of all, I'm tired of reading about New York City, Upper East Side, private school mothers. There's been so many stupid books. Not stupid. I'm sorry. I shouldn't say that.
No,
There's been so many books
Go
written
on.
About that. it's a well-traveled road. So I thought, you know, as a class mom, which is what I wanted to write about, it doesn't uniquely happen in New York or Los Angeles or, you know, some coastal city. And I thought, you know, when I talked to my friends who live all over the country, they said, absolutely, I was a class mom and it was the worst. And let me tell you what happened to me. So I thought I need to put it somewhere that everybody can relate to. And Kansas City on the map is very close to the geographic center of the United States, which I think is Lebanon, Kansas. And I thought, you know what, if I just put it in the middle, it'll make everybody feel like they're included.
Okay. So
I hope, anyway,
can I, in an effort to maybe bridge a gap here, can I suggest something? Because it sounds
yes.
like in some ways for you, Kansas City equals a place that everyone can relate to. The idea that it could that this stuff happens everywhere and anywhere, but like that Kansas
yeah.
City kind of represents anywhere and everywhere.
I mean, I hope that's not insulting to say that. It's just a nice town where there are nice people and, you know, this happens there too.
But so for a lot of your readers on the coast, I'm guessing that that is a reasonable guess as to how they would interpret the setting. But for readers in Kansas City doesn't represent anywhere and everywhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, obviously it doesn't. It has its own personality. It has incredible city spirit for their teams, for just, you know, the uniqueness of the town itself. And I mean, I didn't mean to diminish it in any way.
I think we're having a productive conversation because Kansasitians do get upset regularly by the way people on the coasts represent us. So I'm trying to like have a breakthrough here.
Right. But you haven't read the books. So you don't really know how I represent it. So
I have started.
Actually the first one, the class mom is a love letter to Kansas City. And anybody who says it isn't, I mean, the people that wrote me were basically nitpicking about, you know, that you couldn't drive from this place in 45 minutes. So, you know, get your facts straight. And to them, I apologize. And that's why I wrote the note in the second book. But yeah, no, I can't wait to come to your city. I've been reading about it and researching for 5 years.
Have you been to Kansas City?
No, I've never been.
How did you set a book here?
I wanted to be somewhere in the middle of the country. That's, you know, it was geographically sort of where I started. And the internet is an amazing thing. I mean, you don't really have to go anywhere to find out about. I've looked at pictures. I've read restaurant reviews. I've talked to people who live there. You know, but I've never actually gone because I didn't have the money to go at first. And now for the first book, they didn't really want to send me. Now they're sending me to Kansas City and I'm very excited to come.
Well, I'm glad you're excited. Can you walk me through a detail that you researched that you felt really like was working for you as a writer?
That got smashed by somebody else or just one that
Sure, either way.
Well, I mean, I wanted to, you know, she has a 5-year-old boy turning 6. And I was like, where would he have his birthday party? And I searched a bunch of places in the Kansas City area. And I came up with Emerald City Gym because It seemed like it would be a place that they do these great birthday parties, and it's a, you know, big rumpus gym where you can, kids can do a bunch of stuff and adults can as well. I wanted to find the great restaurants. I wanted to find like the best pizza in Kansas City. And, you know, I've read a bunch of reviews, and there was this rivalry between two places, and one of them is Minsky's. And I was trying to furiously looking through the book this morning, trying to remember the other one that you know, it's like, you're either a Minsky's person or a, and I couldn't find the name of the other pizza place, unfortunately, but,
I'm not sure what
that was, you know, another detail. I did that 5 years ago, so I don't really remember, and I haven't read the book in a while. So, but yeah, those are the sort of things that I try to get right.
Have you set books in other cities besides Kansas City and had a different kind of response, or is this a first for you?
Class Mom is my first book. I came to writing late in my life. I was a broadcaster for 25 years. So it was my first launch into fiction, into the world of setting something somewhere else. And
so,
and I've loved it.
After the response to your first book, were you at all tempted to have the heroine Jen Dixon move to a new city before the second book as like a convenient plot point?
No, she loves Kansas City. She was born and raised there. She's never leaving. She's a lifer.
She would not resentfully move somewhere else just for the convenience of you not having to set another book here. Because it sounds like Kansas City put you through some stuff.
No, they didn't at all. No, I wish you knew my sense of humor. The no more hate mail was kind of a joke. And the worst.
Oh, no, I get that it was a joke.
Oh, okay. The actual worst argument I got into with someone from Kansas City was not about Kansas City, but about a recipe for something that you serve at a Seder, at a Jewish Seder called haroset. And I said, there's a nut-free version, which there is because they serve it in New York. And she, you know, took me to task saying there's no such thing as nut-free haroset, and wrote letter after letter to my publisher and editor complaining that I had said this in the book. So, I mean, you know.
So some readers take details very seriously.
Yeah. But, you know, I take details seriously. And in the second book, the kids go on a class trip to the Shawnee Indian Mission. And I really wanted to know everything about that. And I also reached out to a Native American from Kansas City to make sure that everything I was saying was not only accurate, but inoffensive, and the jokes I was telling were okay to tell, and he was very, very helpful.
Well, as you have noted, I have only just started reading You've Been Volunteered, and Jen's husband wanting to expand his yoga empire to Lawrence and Topeka sounds totally plausible to me. I will admit that you may have lost me a little bit with the one in Branson, but I'm not going to send you any hate mail about it.
You know what? I've been to Branson. So I can tell you that.
Oh, that's funny. Tell me about your trip to Branson.
They need some yoga in Branson. No, I a friend of ours runs the Titanic exhibit there, which I don't know if you've ever been. It's fantastic. And we went specifically to see that and to see her. And it was a wonderful trip. It was when the kids were really little and we had such a good time.
So you've mentioned, I know that hate mail is putting it strongly for the purposes of humor, but is there one letter that you received that just reverberates in your mind that you'd like to respond to while you've got Kansas City's attention?
I don't think there's one in particular. I just wanted Kansas City to know that, you know, after the emails or the mails I did get, I took writing the second book very seriously and was much more intent on making sure the information I had was as accurate as humanly possible.
You are planning a trip?
Yeah, I'm coming out to, I'm going to do some television and I'm going to do a book signing.
When will you be in Kansas City? What are your things that after researching the city for your books, you're really most excited to do and see for yourself?
Have you been to the Mud Pie Cafe?
I have.
Okay, so I can't wait to go there. I hear their stuff is fantastic.
Over on 39th Street.
On 39th Street, exactly, which is a nice outdoor area, apparently in the summer, but the wintertime it just fills with snow. I'm just looking at my calendar to see when I'm actually... Oh, the Tuesday the 30th, And Wednesday the 31st, I'm in Kansas City of July, 31st of July.
Oh, pretty soon. And, well, it should not be snowy then.
No. I'm excited to see all of it.
All right. Well,
I want to go to Garazzo's and I want to go to Jay Gilbert's. And there's tons of stuff I want to do.
Lori Gelman, thanks so much for chatting.
Oh, pleasure, Gina. Thank you.
Lori is the author of the Class Mom novels. They are set in Kansas City, and the new one is called You've Been Volunteered. That's a wrap for today's show. You can hear any of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have them ready for you by the end of the day. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, there's a lot of very public discussion about the state of the Jackson County Detention Center, the conditions inside that facility for inmates. What is going on with that? Why is Kansas City struggling in this way? We'll get firsthand perspectives tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf, Chris Young, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, and Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.